Hello, everyone, and welcome to the first discussion portion of Tolkien Day. I am very lucky to have the indefatigable Mr. D with me. Hello, sir.
Hello, AM. Very, very, very happy to be here.
Absolutely wonderful to have you on. Now, we are going to be talking about the Tolkien aesthetic. So I've tried to sort of organize Tolkien Day that we're covering off most bases regarding him. We're talking about his, the political sort of aspects of Lord of the Rings. We're talking about the literary aspects of Lord of the Rings, various artistic aspects to it as well. There's a biography. But I thought, obviously a huge amount of people are sort of drawn to the aesthetic of the films at least. And to a lesser extent, perhaps the illustrations of Tolkien himself, say, for example, in The Hobbit. But I'm very much interested to explore the imagery of the Lord of the Rings, not just the illustrations themselves, but the cartography element of Tolkien, of course, the various maps, and perhaps a little note on the calligraphy of his constructed alphabets as well. But I thought, Mr. D, as a fellow Tolkien fan and as the resident art expert within our circle, would be the perfect person to have on. And I do believe this is the first stream where you and I have ever been on outside of unpopular opinion. So this is quite an occasion. Anyway, regarding an introduction, is there anything you want to sort of say in summary before we start?
Well, I will add that I was I think like a lot of people, I was unfamiliar with Tolkien's I mean the extent of his body of visual artwork. I mean, I knew that he drew, and obviously I knew that some of his illustrations appeared in various editions of of his books, especially The Hobbit and The Lord of the Rings. But I don't think anyone really knew the extent to which he was sort of involved in the kind of visualization of his ideas and in art in general. And I think it came out relatively recently. And I would say that in the past certainly 20 years or so, there a lot of the work that has ended up in the Bodleian Library has basically been exhibited and come to light. There have been catalogues published on it. So it's getting a lot more exposure. And I'm sort of interested in the idea of placing Tolkien within the tradition of the visual arts, not just as a kind of side, sort of a hobbyist, as I think he's kind of regarded or was regarded in the past.
Absolutely. So for this process, you have selected several images for me, essentially. We've got about 40 images to go through. I've got a couple of notes at the end, but we'll see if we have time to go through them. And we'll essentially go through these images, and you can explain your thoughts as to how this pertains to Tolkien. And it should also be noted for the stream that Tolkien's work also includes a lot of illustrations for some of his other children's novels. And we're going to be focusing on the Tolkien aesthetic, as in the Tolkien aesthetic pertaining to the Legendarium, things relating to the Silmarillion, the Lord of the Rings, and the Hobbit itself, not to the extensive literary oeuvre beyond the Lord of the Rings, to keep the topic on the Legendarium, if that is all right. So without further ado, let us start with this first picture. Which I believe is Uccello's St. George and the Dragon.
Yes, Uccello's St. George and the Dragon. And, I sort of put this in here as a starting point. I have a lot of images at the beginning, which sort of I was trying to kind of trace the variety of influences upon Tolkien's visual aesthetic. And he was to some extent the product of his day, and there were certain sort of strains going around. I mean, now of course this painting is quite familiar. Should be quite familiar to most people. It's a very famous painting in the National Gallery in London. And I think it sort of presents this this idea that had been by the time of Uccello had been firmly established of the kind of chivalric idea of what the distant quote Middle Ages were like. I think that it was very much this work, and as well as illuminated manuscripts before this time, that I think to later generations really cemented the idea of what this the kind of quasi fantastical world of the past, and certainly the European past, and specifically the British past, the world was like. And I think that I also put this because I think in the 19th century, sort of when Tolkien was kind of born, or the milieu he was born into, experienced a kind of huge revival of interest in these ideas of chivalry and in the Middle Ages, the depictions of the kind of medieval world. So if you think of the Pre-Raphaelite artists, and William Morris, and just in general, there was a huge mania for a kind of medieval aesthetic. But it was very much an aesthetic that was not so much contingent upon being accurate to the period. You know, it was very much laced with kind of fancy and fantasy. And so I think that's something very important to keep in mind, because you know, again, this is the world that Tolkien was born into, and I do think that it had probably had a heavy influence on the way he imagined his own kind of creations.
Now, in contrast to this, so obviously this is a height of the Renaissance painting. You have given me some of the 36 views of Mount Fuji, which is a part of a Japanese art style called Yokuyo-e, which is essentially late Edo period before the end of the Meiji period, so around 1800-ish. How do you think this informs the work of Tolkien?
Well, I think that again, I'm sort of looking at the various threads in sort of visual art culture that were still very much present at the time, you know, in and around the time of his birth and his growing up. And another huge influence at the time, I mean, aside from the medievalists and Pre-Raphaelites and all of them, was the massive influence of Oriental artwork, specifically Japanese artwork, the influence of that upon European aesthetics of the time. And it can't be overstated. I mean, if you look at groups of artists like the kind of post-impressionist, like Vincent van Gogh and to a lesser extent Gauguin, Henri Toulouse-Lautrec, and these were artists who were hugely influenced by this kind of graphical culture of Japan that had, of course, also was really kind of beginning to make purchase in Europe at the time. And if you think of, Gilbert and Sullivan and the Mikado and things like that, I mean, this aesthetic of a real world that was also a kind of a distant fantasy, I think had a huge influence on the artistic culture of the time. And also what helped these works to circulate is that they were, they were relatively inexpensive. I mean, these were all, the Hokusai's prints. I mean, they're all woodcuts. And so they were at the time, relatively easy to kind of, and easy and cheap to come across. And so, they had huge circulation. And so I think that, there's a strange mixture of both this kind of Eastern aesthetic and this kind of mythos of the kind of ancient history of Europe and of Britain that we're all kind of mixing around at the time.
Yes, I think just to elucidate on this point, I mean, hopefully you'll correct me, and hopefully I won't sound like too much of a Philistine. But obviously, when we're talking about Tolkien's academic interests, his main interests were Germanic languages. So he focused on the early history of England, He was particularly fascinated by Gothic. And for people who don't know, Gothic is not just an art style. Gothic was were people and a language. The only branch of East Germanic, which supposedly existed sometime in the Ukraine, and also had a possession in Crimea, which lasted until relatively recently, until the 15th century. But nevertheless, when we look at Tolkien's influences, and I've gone over this with Nathan Hood, the various historical and mythological influences behind Tolkien, they're very much situated within Europe and the idea of Christendom, all the Roman Empire, what have you. However, when I look at his art style, well, not necessarily explicitly in the art style, but definitely in what the art style has inspired, say, for example, in the Peter Jackson adaptation. When I look at, for example, the elven culture and their synergy with nature, for example, I do relate it more to Asian, Japanese, Chinese, Korean civilization than I do to Western civilization. And I think your, bringing up of the these Japanese prints is important because, of course, Tolkien was a landscape painter. A watercolorist, and I do feel that there is some sort of explicit connection or debt he paid to the Japanese landscape painters, especially Hokusai is probably the most famous one. There's also, if I go right to the end of this presentation, there's also a little thing which I want to draw up here, which is the idea of the emblem in the Lord of the Rings, because of course, we're very used to heraldic devices, what have you. But within Tolkien's universe, heraldry in the Christian sense doesn't really exist. And instead, for example, the we have a Numenorean tile, and of course we have the famous emblem of the Silmarillion here. And this is much more recent, and as you can see, doesn't really owe anything to Tolkien at all, but nevertheless it's inspired by him, which is the recent book, The Fall of Gondolin, which was published only 3 years later. But I think really it's trying to pay more into the Game of Thrones aesthetic here. But nevertheless, when I think of the imagery, the symbolism, the emblems of Lord of the Rings, I don't think of quintessential medieval Europe. I'm in fact drawn to these on the image here on the right-hand side. These are emblems or what the Japanese called mons, essentially Japan, for most of its history until relatively recently, was divided into various daimyo lordships, what have you. And each of these clans had a marker, a symbol here, these floral symbols. And I can't help but feel that the Tolkien aesthetic is somehow indebted to this idea of the Japanese markers. So I don't think, I think it runs beyond just the influence on landscapes and possibly the, the latent interest or connection you draw to the elves or what have you. But I think even when you look at the Numenoreans, I mean, looking at this image on the left here at the bottom, one thought I had even was, because if you look at the language, Numenorean is said to have some sort of Semitic origin. So I thought, maybe is this paying lip service to some sort of Arabic tradition? Maybe those the beautiful roofs of, say, for example, the Alhambra or the great mosque in Samarkand, etc. But I thought, in addition to that, these Semitic ideas, I also thought these Japanese mons.
It's a very, very good point, and I would certainly agree that I mean, I've been sort of repeatedly mentioning the, the kind of influence of this medievalism, this European medievalism, but you're right. I mean, it's extraordinarily tempered with something, something elf. I mean, something Eastern, as as you suggested, and I sort of pull in with some other images. That Numenorean tile, I was actually going to include that, and I forgot. But another thing that was quite in circulation in late 19th century, early 20th century was this extraordinarily kind of culture of design and the production of objects. So that Numenorean tile reminds me of nothing more than Minton, what they called encaustic tiles. So it was a very specific method of producing tiles. And I believe that the lobby and the Houses of Parliament have are the floor is Minton in encaustic tiles. I believe they're extensively used in in Pugin's buildings. So yeah, I mean that, and that would again be something that Tolkien would have been aware of. I mean, it would have been in the air. So, and I do think that then again, as you say, the kind of Arabic, Isnic ceramics and things like that were kind of pollinating the Minton aesthetic, and would certainly have filtered through again. I mean, it was this extraordinary period, I think the 19th century and the early 20th century, of this just huge cross-pollination of kind of histories and cultures and visual languages, and so which I think also is in the end what the legendarium turns out to be. It was
Yes,
certainly is a major kind of feeling I get from that.
I'll hold off on the Arab influences, I think, in the calligraphy. But certainly looking to this, there's just one point I want to make, which obviously, looking at the history of art in the Catholic world, in particular the Counter-Reformation and even the medieval world, I can't help but again figure that most of the art tends to focus around, not just landscapes, not just these sort of floral-esque motifs, but also portraiture, sculpture in particular. And yet there is very little of that in Tolkien. And I find that rather interesting, because when I think of cultures with an absence of human sculpture, I tend to think of the iconoclastic cultures, and in particular Arabic culture.
Yes, I mean I do wonder that sort of strain of that's if that strain of iconoclasm has, because of course that's what I mean, if people aren't familiar, that's why I think the calligraphic and the design arts flourish so much in Islamic societies, because there was a prescription upon, depending on where you were and what time period, but there was a general prescription on depicting depicting even animals at certain points. So a lot of these energies had to go into other ways of kind of creating an art and a visual language, which of course was calligraphy and patterning, and of course those things were became very influential as again in the late 19th century.
Yes, absolutely. And just for reference, when Dee is referring to particular times, yes, there were in the early modern period in particular, when you have this wonderful flourishing of Persian miniature painting, especially in the Mughal court, where special attention was paid to the focus on portraiture and the faces, even though it was ostensibly an Islamic culture. So it has gone in and out of fashion, even within Muslim societies. But nevertheless, there is this emphasis, especially within early Islam, on iconoclasm. So now we arrive at this image, Mr. D.
Yeah, so this is Aubrey Beardsley, an illustration from Aubrey Beardsley. I've got to look at my notes here. I can't remember what this was, what this publication was from. But I mean, Beardsley is another example of an illustrator working at in the very the sort of late 19th century, very much associated with Victorians. And I detect a certain Again, a certain influence on maybe if not Tolkien specifically, but certainly on the visual culture of the time. And Beardsley again was sort of imbibing these kind of Eastern influences to some degree. People are familiar with Art Nouveau, which was a whole sort of movement of art and design associated with France, but it was also present in Britain and elsewhere. And very much this idea of generating sort of design and decoration in art through kind of botanical motifs, and it's something that really reminds me of the elven kind of culture and way of seeing the world. And I almost and even in the Peter Jackson films, I think that there is very much a kind of almost Art Nouveau Beardsleyan kind of hint to that, to their design and their architecture. And I do wonder if that was intentional. I've looked through lots of Alan Lee's production drawings, and but yeah, I was certainly curious about that. But again, these were very much the tenor of the times.
Yes. And for people who don't know, Alan Lee is one of the most famous and principal Tolkien illustrators. But definitely, when we look at the construction of, say, for example, Rivendell, I do sort of believe that the Art Nouveau influence is tangible. And of course, I do sort of believe that, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but Art Nouveau, roughly sort of the inception of it is around 1880 through to about 1910. I do believe that there is also some sort of, even if it's not explicit, some sort of Asian influence on the Art Nouveau process, in part because of the interaction, especially because the Meiji Restoration would have only happened, a couple of decades before. Do you think that's fair?
I think that's certainly fair. Yes, and I mean, I wonder, in fact, that almost seems to be certainly visually something that comes more up more in the films. I mean, as we'll see later on, I have one of Tolkien's own watercolors of Rivendell, and it's a very different interpretation from from the one in the film.
Wonderful. So moving on, we have, I believe this is William Morris.
Yes, this is a tapestry done by John Henry Durl, a company for Morris and Co. Again, this speaks to the kind of revival of this idea, this sort of revival of both the kind of medieval-ish visual world, and also this extraordinary interest in kind of botanical patterning, and schemata, and this is, if you when you think about the way that Tolkien writes about the kind of natural world of the Legendarium, and certainly, as can be seen in many of his illustrations, this sort of I think pervading influence of the time is visible. In the work. But I'm also interested, of course, in that this was very, the late 19th century was very much the age of kind of, it was not in, as I said earlier, was not interested in kind of historical accuracy as much. It was interested in influence and interpretation. This is this, I mean, if you weren't aware, you would perhaps mistake this for a tapestry from a much earlier period. There's almost an element of kind of trying to think of a word. I don't want to say fakery, but that there was this sense of kind of basically reimagining the worlds of the past in a kind of historically informed but fanciful way. And it was certainly something that would would certainly have been an influence on the development of a kind of fantasy writer.
No, I think that's completely fair. I mean, the literary development, of course, we're talking about this reimagining the medieval world. Of course, a large sort of part of later German romanticism is essentially that. But relating this back to Germany, of course, a couple of decades before Tolkien, we of course have the Brothers Grimm, who, in addition to being the great compilers of German folklore and fairy tales, were of course philologists like Tolkien, focusing on the German language. And so I believe that that influenced the artistic trends and the literary trends, all tending towards this. Again, because even focusing on Tolkien, read these works. He read history into these works, and there is a rich sort of element of history you can read into the Lord of the Rings still. And I think the 19th century, the later 19th century especially, is this wonderful culmination of fantasy elements and this attempt to realize some form of the past, even if it is in some way imagined. So moving on to here.
This is another William Morris tapestry. I also included a number of these Morris things because Tolkien had at least one book of Morris's in his library. So I can't remember which one. I think it was maybe Morris's book about symbols and patterning. It was very much one of Morris's kind of explanatory textbooks. And so I do know that Morris would have been a you know a, an ident a real identifiable influence, or at least someone that Tolkien was was familiar with and was perhaps interested in. So
No,
but again, I mean this
I think that.
go on,
Sorry,
sorry.
I think that's my reading of it, especially. I mean, even in the various sort of architectural influences for I think it's William Morris's house and the Shire. I think there exists that, but I think obviously William Morris is the height of the arts and crafts movement in the UK. I think the influence is tangible, and of course, this is. Directly contemporaneous. I mean, most of Tolkien's sort of formation period, is around the First World War prior to it, which is really the height of William Morris. So I think, yes, it's very clear to me to sort of illustrate that direct connection to William Morris. This painting in particular, I do get a Philip Veit ring to it. His epic images of Germania in particular.
Exactly. I could have I thought about putting that in there. I mean, I'm not as familiar with kind of Germanic strains of the of this time, but certainly like for everyone from Caspar David Friedrich to onward would certainly also have been there. I also, I recently listened to your stream with Columba about the sagas, and I was very interested in that because it was again the kind of reintroduction of a kind of an ancient text, that came as new to a lot of people. It was really the first time that people would have experienced something that had been around for, for centuries, and so there was an idea of even finding even the sort of ancient and old becoming new again at the time. As you say, I mean, of course, the Germanic and other cultures had a huge influence on Tolkien.
I mean, thematically, that is absolutely spot on, of course, because what was one of Tolkien's sort of great passions, it was not just language creation but language reconstruction. So when you're trying to find preceding languages, when there is a lack of written records in particular, or there doesn't exist a oral tradition anymore, a lot of philology is dedicated towards language reconstruction. So in Tolkien's case, it was literally rediscovering a form of the past to the best of his capabilities, essentially. And here we have.
This is William Morris. William Morris had a founded a press called the Kelmscott Press, in I believe 1891, something like that, and published quite a number of very, very elaborate editions. This is the Kelmscott Chaucer, which is a heavily, heavily illustrated and designed book, and I think again would certainly have had a profound influence upon the times, and Tolkien probably saw this, but it's very much the kind of the modern person's idea of a kind of an ancient tome in a way. It's something that is that has the air of it has an ancient air about it, but is of course thoroughly kind of modern in its conception and the production. So very 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 curious book, but and also again the reference to Chaucer, this sort of idea of weaving the tales of travelers together, seemed to have some pertinence to Tolkien, to me anyway.
Oh, you're completely right, Mr. D, because Tolkien was a professor of Middle English, and I believe there is a essay or article on Chaucer's The Canterbury Tales, there might be a translation of the Reeve's Tale, which is the third of the Canterbury Tales. He definitely wrote extensively on it. And yes, there is an essay, Chaucer as a philologist. So if we have William Morris and Geoffrey Chaucer combined here, I think almost certainly Tolkien would have taken inspiration from this, due to that specific overlap between those two inspirations.
Yes. Excuse me. Yeah, hang on, let me get to my notes again. Yeah, and I think it also I'm quite interested in of course I think by nature and politics, Tolkien and Morris, I mean they had these sorts of, I think, cultural affinities, but they were also kind of completely divergent characters in other ways. I mean, William Morris being heavily associated with kind of burgeoning socialist movement at the time, and of course Tolkien being, quite different, and much more of a explicit reactionary. So, yeah, curious tendencies there.
And what about this image in particular, or just a continuation from the sentiments of the previous slide?
Yeah, it's a, again just a continuation. There's another page from the Kelmscott Chaucer. This is the Wife of Bath's tale, but you can see this extraordinary kind of visual fullness, and kind of pattern on pattern, and using sort of symbols and decoration, but also the incorporation of text and type within a design, and I think Tolkien's keen interest in philology and calligraphy and language, as well as the kind of visual arts, I mean that th this was a this was certainly a rife time for for that kind of flourishing of a sort of polyvalent artistic approach to a work. So quite impressed by these Kelmscott books.
Absolutely, they're wonderful to look at. So moving on to this painting.
So I wanted to put in a few images. This is John Paul Nash, sorry. And this was just a sort of spring landscape from about 1914. Very much in a kind of formative time for Tolkien. But I put these in here because I think there's also something that happened with the imagining of the British landscape at the time with various artists. And Paul Nash was a war artist as well, and so I do think there's certainly a kind of connection there. I don't know if there was any kind of explicit contact between them, but it's sort of very curious to me that both Tolkien and Nash were, had this sort of experience of both the kind of imagining of the landscape and also with the the Great War. This is another. Hey, this is actually by Nash as well. But it, this there was also, I would say, British painting of the period was, I would say, slightly less sort of adventurous than certain concomitant movements on the continent, but there was a very slow trickle of kind of ideas of modernism. I mean, if you remember the Hokusai from a few minutes ago, if people think about those images and the way that he's actually kind of constructing a landscape from the far distance to things very close up, especially noticeable in the second image. I mean, this kind of almost vertical arrangement of the landscape. And it's a very different way of sort of imagining space and imagining the arrangement of shapes in space. This is something I think that very clearly came through from the influence of kind of Japanese art, which had the largest kind of influence on in Britain, because you know Britain's contact with Japan in the Meiji period and all that. So I do think you start to see this kind of slight simplification and almost slight abstraction being applied to something very traditional like British landscape, which of course is a huge subject. I mean, landscape is traditionally one of the, I would say, one of the keen and abiding subjects of British painters, sort of reaching its flowering in the, you know, the 18th century with Constable and such artists. But you know, I think with Nash and with Stanley Spencer and other artists of that you know of the period, you see this kind of influence and this new way of arranging the countryside, arranging the landscape, and arranging people and buildings and such within it that you see very explicitly in Tolkien's watercolors, which we'll see quite soon. This is again just another paint. This is by John Nash, Lane Through a Quarry. This is a slightly later painting. This is, I think, 1950s. But you know, again, this almost kind of Cézanne-like ordering of the landscape and the kind of distance becoming a vertical construction. If you want to get to the next slide. This is Stanley Spencer, another sort of very well-known English artist at the time. But again, the very particular kind of realities of what a British landscape was, just because of the nature of of the kind of landscape and lay of the terrain here. I think. Bear a great influence on artists at the time. And so next is, this is actually Tolkien.
Yes, yes. This is a very famous painting, but yes, I can definitely see almost wonderfully set up the culmination of all of those influences which you've given us here. Would you like to elaborate?
Yes, I mean, all those things I was sort of babbling about, but you know, again, the sort of vertical arrangement, this kind of piling and construction, this slight flattening, you know. So of course we think of the specifically the Italian Renaissance and the Northern Renaissance as being this kind of discovery, also this discovery of how to do correct perspective and how to do atmospheric perspective, you know, this great sort of idea of kind of bringing the visual arts out of the kind of slightly naive naive world of the Middle Ages and into the great flowering of the Renaissance. And you know, so what's curious though, of course, is that as you know, in the 19th century and certainly in the 20th century, there was almost a kind of wholesale not rejection of that idea, but this notion that there were other ways of kind of constructing an image that faithfulness to visual and optical reality isn't the be all and end all of creating an image. Mm. You know, that also, I mean, something lost, I think, in the humanism and rationalism of the Renaissance was this idea that was certainly a huge part of image making in earlier periods and in the medieval period and in other cultures, obviously, in, as we talked about Japan, the Orient and such. I mean, this idea that images weren't just reflections of what you saw, but they were also conveyors of meaning, conveyors of kind of relationships and symbolic relationship and you know, kind of arcane knowledge and revelations of, of religious revelations, philosophical exploration, that adherence only to the optical was not the most fruitful direction to go in art. And so I think you did see this great sort of searching for other modes of expression. And this would have appealed to Tolkien greatly, because of course, as we see in all of his work, this huge sort of fondness and love for the kind of things under the surface, for the meaning of kind of symbols and the meaning of, the kind of language of inherent in nature and things like that, all of which have nothing to do with this kind of scientific, kind of humanistic idea of the visual being, the visual arts being just a reflection or a mirror of nature. So, and I think that would have been greatly meaningful to someone of Tolkien's, interests.
Well, thank you for that summary, Mr. D. And this, of course, is the original Rivendell, before it's later enlarging as a result of Peter Jackson's
Yeah, much
yes.
less of a much less of a grand much less of a sort of grand imagining. I will say I forgot to kind of mention that, although I've been talking so much about the British countryside, one of the huge influences on Tolkien was actually the landscape of Switzerland
Yes,
and of the Alps.
absolutely. And that's in particular, just to elucidate, I believe he holidayed in Switzerland. What was it? It would have been in 1911. And he later wrote that this was an incredibly formative experience. Essentially, he imagined that he himself had traversed up to the Lonely Mountain. He had been in the company of the dwarves. And I think this idea of trying to recreate that original holiday in Switzerland is a motif that's running throughout a lot of his works, and the obsession with hills and mountains. So yes, in terms of Tolkien's direct experience.
Yes, and of course, also there's the idea of kind of, that different types of landscape reflect the different realities of the races of Middle Earth, and that Mordor is the landscape of Mordor is a reflection upon the character of those who live there, and then Rivendell would be a reflection of the character of the elves there, and Lothlorien would be a, it would be the same. And also, of course, the Shire and Hobbiton is kind of home. I mean, that is the kind of British countryside. And then, of course, as you sort of move out from that, you start to get these very different, almost alien landscapes. And of course, the landscape of the Alps, as we talked about, which was, I think, influential not only to his conception of Rivendell, but yeah, as the Lonely Mountains, the Misty Mountains, and all of that. So.
Yes, and I think one of this, the striking thing about this image is that it does convey a sentiment very similar to the previous image, which of course was the road that goes on and on towards the towards Bag End. And I do sort of look at this image and feel, it is home. It is comforting to look at. But obviously, in Peter Jackson's adaptation, this is of course literally the House of Elrond. It is much grander in conception, more like a palace or some sort of lordly estate, which perhaps, if Lord of the Rings was a realized, a fully conceived universe, it's probably more realistic. But nevertheless, I think there is this parochialism to Tolkien's work, which I find very endearing, very comforting. So.
Yes, absolutely, and which I think is not entirely reflected in, of course, the design of. I mean, if you're making a kind of epic trilogy of films, obviously you're going to have to kind of have a sort of visual language that's going to reflect that. But yeah, I certainly agree with you. This idea of home, this comforting idea of home, and all again the idea that of all the kind of pathways and such leading either home and away. And I think you see that in so many of these Tolkien images that are sort of bisected or traversed by a path or a road or a stream or something. There's there's always something to draw you from the foreground into the far distance and back again, to steal a phrase there. So yeah, and so this is Bilbo, this would be more from the Hobbit, but I mean, I see an extraordinary relationship between, again, this and those Paul and John Nash kind of watercolors of the time. And also, you know, the kind of the what would be called the sublime. So if you think of again, think back to the 19th century, in America, it's sort of associated with America, actually, is the notion of the kind of like the Hudson River School painters, this sort of painting of the landscape as a representation of the sublime, of the kind of awesome and unknowing nature of kind of God and God's creation. And there's always a kind of placement of man within the sort of vastness of the landscape. And of course, in the case of the hobbits, I mean, they were really literally dwarfed by almost everything that they encountered, you know, as they moved away from the Shire. So I think that the sublime is also kind of entering into this visual world as well. This is just a watercolor of Lothlorien from Tolkien. Again, I mean, as you see, it's very different in conception. I mean, in Peter Jackson's imagination and the production designer's imagination of Lothlorien, I mean, it's a very different place, and there's very much a kind of sense. I mean, even with great personages like Galadriel and Celeborn and such, there is always a kind of sense of connection to the earth and a kind of human scale, maybe, if that's not an exaggeration, that of course you don't get in the film. There's much more of a kind of grandness and aloofness to the design of you know, of these various places, certainly the elf places in the film. So
Absolutely, but I think just looking at this picture, I still do get this idea of grandeur and, you know, serenity, but also there's almost like a timeless aspect to this picture. And in particular, Galadriel is an immortal being, and if anything, she represents the endurance of this idea of some sort of you know, relationship between sentient beings and nature. I think in Galadriel, that's probably the most exemplified. I think if I were to look at Peter Jackson, I think he retains elements of that. I mean, Lothlorien, you know, the Elfindom, which is, you know, which is Lothlorien, is still wedded to this idea of, you know, harmony with nature, albeit, in, as you mentioned, in a far grander and ostentatious manner than is conceived of here. So yes, moving on. And this, of course, is the I believe the entrance to Moria.
Yes, the entrance to Moria. I we also quite like this because if you see in the middle of the water that tentacle poking up,
The Watcher.
the watcher in the water. Yeah, I mean, just that hint of danger there. But you know, so I'm struck by how much you know, I think that the kind of vision of Moria, the exterior of Moria in the film is very close to this, you know, obviously much more kind of rusticated, but you know, so there are kind of times where they're quite faithful to I would say Tolkien's vision than others if you're making the comparison to the film.
Yes, and this image is wonderful. It does conjure up a sense of foreboding doom, you know, both in the water but also in the mountains above,
Yeah.
and in the impenetrability of the mountains. This is the case with all of these dwarven cities. There's just one thing I wanted to know. How do you rate Tolkien's competence as an artist?
I would say that he's fairly advanced. I would say he's a fairly advanced amateur. I mean, there's certain weaknesses that I see in the images that, again, would be, are just the hallmarks of someone who doesn't have explicitly sort of the technical training that would be required to pull some of these things off. I think that there's extraordinary sophistication in others, the images. I mean, again, he's someone who I think if he'd pursued visual arts as his sort of main focus, it would have, he would have been he would have risen above the kind of world of the amateur, but I mean, I'm again, because it's him, and because, of course, the idea of seeing this world that he, this world of his creation through his own visions of it, put down on paper, I'm willing to forgive some of the slight kind of technical issues with some of the images. So.
Yes, and of course, I think Tolkien can be forgiven. I'm not going to say mediocrity, because there is, I would say, definite talent in here. But Tolkien would truly be a Renaissance man if, on top of all of this, he was a superlative artist.
Yeah, and as I said, I mean, he's well advanced of just sort of average, your average person. Certainly the
Yes.
average output of many writers that I've seen delve into the visual art. So yes,
Indeed.
I think again, had he focused on that and developed it, I mean, he certainly could have been quite or quite competent professional.
Wonderful. And here we are faced with one of the great eagles.
Yes, which is again the sort of relationship of the landscape to the figure is just something I really like so much. I don't know if it's specifically what this scene is because that appears to be I don't know if that's Frodo or Bilbo there but certainly, the production designers for Peter Jackson's kind of would have been aware of this story.
I'm almost sort of believe there's some sort of Beatrix Potter-esque image, especially in the rendering of the eagle. I know Beatrix Potter was a significant influence, especially because Tolkien was illustrating for his children. That should be emphasized. He wasn't there was an amateurish quality because he wasn't doing this professionally, of course. And when look at his non-associated paintings with the Legendarium, it is with this idea of again, appealing to children and writing and illustrating for children's books. Of course, he did submit many of his own illustrations to The Hobbit. I believe the publisher rejected the majority of them, but
Yeah,
eight found their way into.
they were all rejected at first. I mean, certainly for the first editions, I think only a couple of maps and maybe a couple of examples of calligraphy. Even in the Lord of the Rings, in the first edition. So, yeah, he was overruled.
It is remarkable, actually, sort of looking at the history of the publications, especially with the Lord of the Rings, because The Hobbit was more of a happy accident for Ronald Tolkien. But with the Lord of the Rings, especially, it is remarkable looking at how utterly sort of scathing and underwhelmed they were by the project. And of course, here we have one of the most famous illustrations of Smaug. I have a version. I think I have a copy of that somewhere. I should know. But anyway, obviously, this is one of the most iconic images from Lord of the Rings. If you haven't sort of if you're not familiar with the films.
Certainly. I am actually quite unfamiliar with the Hobbit films. I only saw one of them. So I'm not particularly sure how the depiction of Smaug held up in those, but
Yes, I think I mean I can't remember because I was I'd, at one point I was following the making of the Hobbit films with great interest, and I believe there were supposed to be two of them, not three, And they had a different director, I can't remember who it was, but the idea, I believe, was that there's supposed to be an entirely different aesthetic to The Hobbit to match the tone. And of course, they ended up just getting Lord of the Rings 2, essentially. It's Lord of the Rings prequel, essentially The Hobbit. It doesn't have the same tone as the book. And of course, as it is Peter Jackson, it is envisaged as this, you know, grand Lord of the Rings as epic. And I think because of that, I don't rate The Hobbit, especially from an aesthetic point of view, because I do just see it as a continuation of Lord of the Rings. You know, I'm far more sort of enticed by an image such as this, as opposed to the Benedict Cumberbatch rendition of Smaug.
Yes. Well, also, I think it kind of mischaracterizes the tone of The Hobbit, which, of course, has has a very different feel. The book certainly from that film. You know, they try to make a kind of le grand epic. You know, and it isn't quite the character of the book. So, incidentally, it was meant to be Guillermo del Toro.
Toro, yes. Director. That's the name I was trying to think of.
And I get the, I mean, I got the impression from the one Hobbit film that I saw that Peter Jackson's heart wasn't in it. You know, it just seemed like it wasn't the kind of project of a lifetime that The Lord of the Rings was for him.
No.
I suspect so.
No, and I don't want to fault Peter Jackson at all. I mean, I may, you know, occasionally throw dispersions at the adaptation we've got, but in hindsight, I say that the Lord of the Rings adaptation we got certainly was the best possibly conceivably we could have ever got. When it comes to the Hobbit, I'm less forgiving, unfortunately.
Yeah,
I would much prefer a single film, a single 2-hour film, which matched the tone of the book. But nevertheless, here we are. But focusing on the actual sort of image itself, is there anything you would like to elaborate?
Well, I'm struck by the slightly comical nature of the dragon. You know, I mean, obviously, I think it's in keeping so much with as what we were talking about with the tone of the book. I mean, it's you know, it's less the kind of horror of the, you know, kind of ring wraith, or, you know, and it's more this slightly kind of fairy tale dragon. You know, so
it's interesting, really, isn't it? Because of course the influence, there are two sort of influences for this. One is, of course, Nimhogg, which is the you know, the dragon at Ragnarok, the stealer of souls. But the other influence is Fafnir, the troll transformed into a dragon on his hoard of gold. And I find it interesting how Tolkien is able to take a rather intimidating creature such as Fafnir, who is often the object of, you know, especially, you know, Siegfried or whatever, slaying the dragon. And here, there's almost the inversion of that, because, of course, Bilbo is not a great warrior and will never be. And instead, we have this you know, wonderful conversation, which is, you know, one of my favourite parts of the book. And I think Smaug is drawn to reflect that.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And you know, I mean, it's again, sort of a slightly, I don't know, I would say comical character, but you know, there is a sort of sense of I don't know, humor or lightness or something,
playful subversion, perhaps.
Yes, exactly. Very good. You know, that of course is missing from the kind of po-faced Cumberbatchian. Yeah.
Well, yes, I mean the dragon iteration we got in the Peter Jackson version is supposed to be horrifying and intimidating. And of course, within this conception, he would still be to Bilbo, who will be awed and terrified by and is by Smaug. But nevertheless, this is a an iteration which is far more in keeping with the tone, which is something we'll keep banging on, but nevertheless. And this was an interesting addition. This is the... I'm not going to try and pronounce the Latin, sadly. I've got a very bad throat at the moment.
This is the Hypnerotomachia polyphili. That's just the way I've always pronounced it, but I'm sure it's done in a way. But this is a book published in 1499, possibly by Francesco Colonna, but the authorship is not known for certain. I mean, this is a very, very well-known book, printed by the Aldine Press of Aldus Manutius. If people aren't familiar with it, you should really go out and kind of look into it, because it's a really fascinating book. And anyone sort of interested in the idea of kind of esoteric knowledge and symbology and sort of mystical allegory, I think would be very interested in this work.
Do you want to elaborate on it?
I mean, the title means something like the dream of Polyphilus, or the strife of love in a dream, I think it's often rendered. And it basically is the sort of telling of ostensibly of a dream, but it's very much a kind of highly arcane allegorical journey of the protagonist, Polyphily. Polyphilo, as he pursues, amongst other things, love through a kind of fantastical landscape and fantastical world. And I put this in. I mean, it's just my conjecture. I don't know. I'm sure that Tolkien would have been familiar with this, although I don't know to what extent. Like, I can't be sure of that. But there's so many kind of parallels to many of the things we see in Tolkien's imagination of the Legendarium and such. I mean, the interest again in symbols, the interest in kind of fantasy and in constructing a world in the world as kind of allegory, a religious allegory and philosophical allegory, of the idea of kind of landscape and travel being also kind of laden with meaning in a certain way. And I think it's sort of added on top of that is that we don't actually know really what the nature and quote true meaning of this work is. So I certainly see it as a kind of precedent for the at least for, if not specifically for Tolkien, but certainly for the type of work that he produced.
Well, I'm going to probably add my mandatory Wagner reference for one stream,
Oh, yeah.
and I do think based on my limited knowledge of it, I do think there is an allusion you can draw between the Venus Book in Tannhäuser to the Fountain of Venus in Polyphilo. So that's just my one little Wagnerian chip there, but
Yeah. There's a wonderful
yeah.
illustration of that fountain in this work. I mean, this work, it's not just a kind of literary work, but it's also the Aldine edition is completely full of
Yeah.
the most beautiful woodcut illustration you could possibly imagine.
And just for reference, this would be about 500 years old.
I think it was published in 1499. I mean, again, it's certainly been well known throughout history. I believe Francois Rabelais mentions it in Gargantua and Pantagruel. I mean, it was certainly known at the time, and I think remained known, if not again, I think because it's so kind of arcane and strange and difficult to place in kind of history, in literary history otherwise. I think that it's always been a kind of a maybe not the most famous thing, but I'm certainly known to people of a kind of literary artistic bent.
It was
So I've
interesting.
included some images from the Hypnerotomachia. Sort of I'm just sort of doing a very heavy-handed compare and contrast to certain Tolkien images. So if you go to back. Yeah, I mean, so this is an image from the Hypnerotomachia, and then of course the next image is a Tolkien illustration. I mean, his ink drawings are very different in character, I would say, his watercolor paintings. They're very much more kind of within a sort of a decorative graphical tradition. I think they're very interesting to draw to draw these comparisons. The next is drawing is also another Tolkien drawing. Again, and notice in almost every one there is a path forward.
Yes.
Whether it's and sometimes it's accessible, and sometimes, of course, as in Moria, it's blocked by the formidable mountains and by the Gate of Durin, and here, of course, blocked by the broken, broken bridge and docks and such. But it's a kind of fascinating thing. I mean, to just someone who was so sort of enchanted by this idea of the hero's journey. The next image is another one from the Hypnerotomachia, and the sort of ruins of the obelisk, and so I've sort of put that with the next, the Frodo sitting amongst the oh yeah, what was that place called?
So this would be Frodo traveling through Atilion. So this is on the on the east bank of Nerol's Gilead. I can't remember the exact place, but this is where the flowers are growing on the statue of the king.
Of the king, yes.
I'll
One
probably
of, and
look at
again, one of the few, one of the few.
I'll look it up while you're talking, because it's going to irritate me that I don't know.
Okay. Well, and again, back to the point you made, it's one of the few kind of appearances of human sculpture, of kind of memorial sculpture, and also the sailing between the two monumental sculptures of the king, as well. So.
Yes, I think when you do see statue and imagery, it is very explicitly associated with men, and not just men, the Numenoreans. So the Rohirrim, for example, again, a lot of elements of Tolkien are rather anachronistic if you look at it within some sort of true to life, medieval reenactment or whatever, especially in the Jackson version, because the Gondor we see in The Lord of the Rings is almost early modern in terms of the aesthetic, in terms of the architecture, in terms of the clothing or whatever. However, if you go to Rohan, the aesthetic is almost very early medieval, late Dark Age. So elements of that are anachronistic, but one consistent element is, whether you're at Amon Hen or in Ithilien, because of course, the one aspect of Tolkien's work is, of course, is the decay of men, the fall of man, and obviously the renewal and the anointing of Aragorn and the rechristening and reunification of the kingdom. But you see elements of this. Essentially, the ruin of the kingdom of men, the kingdom of Numenor, appearing as a recurring motif throughout, and not just the books but also the films. And so, this is tangible in this image. This sense of decline, the sense of fall. Of course, this area which Frodo was in, he's in the midst of enemy territory. He's taken the ring to Minas Morgul, which used to be Minas Arnor, which of course was another outpost of Gondor, which has been corrupted and used now as the headquarters of the Witch King of Angmar, the Lord of the Nazgûl. But just focusing on the statues, I do think it's interesting that you have this element particularly associated with one race and none of the others, and how there is no such similar motif recurring in the elves. Again, I'm not quite sure what Tolkien is trying to convey. I mean, one of the elements I've read into Lord of the Rings, and I think I've mentioned it on my stream with Nathan Hood a very long time back, is that there is a an idea that Numenor, at some point Arnor, the United Kingdom men, represented some form of the fall of the Roman Empire. And when you're looking at Minas Tirith, if you're looking at the last remnant of it, or even not that, you're looking at some sort of bastard remnant of it, some sort of rump state, essentially. And all you're left with is the constant reminder of the greatness of this once powerful kingdom. And I think that's perfectly encapsulated in this image.
Yes, and I think it's also notable that, I mean, whenever you see in the films, and I referenced in the book as well, but whenever you do see this kind of more complex sculpture, more complex manifestations of certainly the kingdom of men, it's always presented as a ruin. It's a ruin of the past, a relic of the past. Statues of men are always kind of weathered or broken, the remnants of the Numenoreans. There's almost a kind of sense that you as you said, living in this era of decline and decay, where there isn't sort of nothing new, and there is nothing sort of being produced, there is nothing sort of grand being put up. It's a civilization living off the ends of the sort of memory of times past. So, and that's a very much a romantic idea, that I think certainly pervades perhaps some Tolkien sensibilities about that.
And this, of course, is another illustration from the again, to try and pronounce it, Hymeneotomachia polyphili.
Yes,
polyphili. Yes.
Yeah, the literal dragon there, which I was quite taken by, so the next image is also from Hymeneotomachia, choosing a way forward, and you of course see the kind of pairing of the paths with these inscriptions in Greek and Latin and Arabic and Hebrew. And this struck me so much as it, with its relationship to the next image, which of course is one of the most
absolutely
famous, which is the gate of
the door to Moria.
Moria. Which is faithfully represented in the film. I mean, they used, and this is Tolkien's design. I reversed it. I mean, so one of the humorous anecdotes about Tolkien's attempt to get his illustrations in the first editions of the Lord of the Rings book is that they allowed this. This is, I believe, one of his drawings that was published in the first edition. But he wanted it to be published like this, which is white lines and against a black background, and they wouldn't do it because it was too expensive. So it appears inverted from this. It appears as just a regular line drawing in that edition. But Tolkien wanted it to be like this because, of course, it's the engraving on the door is chased in. Is chased in mithril by elven hands, and so of course this idea that it sort of glows with this light in the moonlight. But this is a sort of heavily drawing on on language and script and calligraphy, but also upon arcane symbols. I mean, this is almost an emblem in the old sense of a kind of illustration with very specific allegorical program.
No, that's fascinating. Thank you. So moving on to the next image.
And this is my last little takeout from the Hymeneotomachia. There's a number of quite elaborate knot. I mean, this is almost like a Celtic knot. Very elaborate sort of calligraphic designs of symbols and emblems. And this is, as you talked about early in the stream, with Tolkien's illustration of the kind of heraldry that we see in the Legendarium, and with the the Numenorean tiles and all of that. I mean, this idea of kind of a very very non-European way of depicting this kind of symbology, this kind of heraldry, and throughout lots of Tolkien's notebooks and drawings, there are I would say almost sort of obsessive interest in drawing patterns and designs, and I think also of the Silmarils and such. I mean, all of that was I descended from this type of kind of line work. So if you go to the next one, this is one of the many, many drawings in Tolkien's papers of his sort of interest in kind of patterning, meaningful patterning, I would say.
And what would you, because I mean, this image is incredible, but other than, you know, elucidating the obvious use of the Tengvar, could you elaborate a bit more on what these possible patterns could mean?
I don't actually know. I mean, what specifically the relationship is here? I mean, I think so much. I mean, that it sort of has, I would say, classical precedence with the kind of patterning you see in certain periods of Greek art, and certain even sort of then into the kind of Roman patterning, but also back to the Islamic, you know, this idea of kind of depicting the mysteries of creation and God through, rather than depicting, you know, sort of humans and animals, sort of depicting that through this kind of almost meditative patterns. And you see this in so many kind of religious traditions, you know, this idea of kind of sort of symbols of meditation, the sort of repetition and the kind of complexity that you could, you know, that your eye gets lost in. So there were just so many, looking through Tolkien's visual artwork, I mean, there was so much of this. The next slide is especially amusing.
I was very intrigued to hear you talk about this one, Dave, when I first saw this. So please do elaborate. This is obviously
a crossword puzzle. Yeah, it's a crossword puzzle from the Times. And again, this is just amongst Tolkien's papers. But, you know, I mean, I don't know if he was having it during the midst of a conversation, maybe he was on the telephone, and doing this sort of thing. I mean, we've all probably done this type of doodling, but of course, in Tolkien's case, it's very sort of majestically ordered and very specific. And you could see, I mean, to me, the most fascinating thing is, of course, the kind of drawing out of this type of patterning from a puzzle, you know. So in a crossword puzzle, I mean, it's a kind of cipher. You know, it's a cipher with a hidden meaning, which you sort of draw out as you step through, you know, the trials presented to you with each clue, and the interconnect, you know, and then you get this sort of series of interconnected words, and you know, and to me, it's just sort of fascinating that Tolkien is maybe not consciously, but he's making a kind of connection between this idea of the kind of puzzle of words and the kind of puzzle of symbols. And very literally, and of course, the case of the adverts around the puzzle. I mean, he's sort of blotting out literal type, blotting out words with, you know, with these very incessant patterns and symbols. Which, of course, again, you see bits and pieces of this show up with like with the Silmarils or that Numenorean tile and such. So this greatly interested me, you know, to see this, because of course it's not specifically. Yeah, you know, these weren't done for kind of public consumption. This is Tolkien thinking and drawing. You know, this is very much the kind of work of the mind in private. which I think is very telling.
But there are many elements to this. I mean, I will admit to doing doodles, not necessarily on the scale or complexity of this, but nevertheless doing these rather extravagant doodles. Of course, the idea of the Hobbit was conceived of via a doodle when he was marking papers.
Marking
But
papers,
other,
yeah.
yes, but other elements of this. Obviously, you mentioned ciphers. Of course, during the Second World War, Tolkien was earmarked as a potential code breaker. So that should come as no surprise to anyone. Another element, of course, is that he secretly communicated to his wife Edith while he was in France during the First World War, using a form of code. And again, this plays into the idea that, with Nod Bosch, the nonsense languages he invented it at King Edward's, etc. And moving on to Teng Va and all of these complicated systems of alphabets and languages, etc. It makes complete sense that you see this element of Tolkien the cold break code breaker, Tolkien the puzzle solver, and Tolkien the doodler, all sort of demonstrated in this piece. So thank you for showing it for showing this, Dee.
Altogether,
And of course, yeah, and
fascinating.
of course, we have one of the most famous. I mean, this is of course the original, the version I've used as the thumbnail, of course, is a later coloring, but this is the original.
Yes, I mean these drawings. I mean, there's others in this series with that have been sort of greatly kind of fleshed out and elaborated. But essentially these were Tolkien's design, and his conception of of a lot of things, certainly with Hobbit architecture. And of course we all know that Peter Jackson was extraordinarily faithful to this vision of the although the scale is slightly grander than I think the film scale of Bag End in the film version. But again, there's I wasn't thinking about it, but even in this image, the way forward, door is open and
Yes,
the path
precisely.
extends into the distance. It's fascinating how many of these images that comes up.
The road goes out from
For
far and
all.
down out of the doorway. Anyway.
Okay, hang on. Yeah, my computer has gone to sleep at a very inopportune time. There we go. This is the Halls of Manwë, a drawing by Tolkien. I thought this was quite interesting because, of course, it's a very different conception of a landscape. I would say much more kind of fantastical. I don't know. It's
I
sort
mean,
of the upper and lower world in a
yes,
very
in terms of lore, this is Tanith Kwetil, which is supposed to be the highest mountain in all the world. And this, of course, is the as you mentioned, this is the dwelling place of Manwë, who is one of the greatest of the Ainur. So I think within Tolkien mythology, of all the mountains, this is the most illustrious of all of them.
Was Manwë the was Manwë the Ainur associated with kind of craft?
No, Manwë was associated with air. Aule was
Owl,
concerned with crafts, yeah.
So there's certainly representations of kind of some of the lore that we get later on in the kind of posthumous work, Silmarillion and such. I'm also struck by the swan boat there. It's really making me think of Wagner again.
We have to add a little a Lohengrin reference here,
Yeah.
but but no, it is it is quite incredible. And of course, confusingly, of course, you mentioned posthumously, most of the Silmarillion, of course, was written long, long before Lord of the Rings. So rather, it would have been the original Silmarillion, which would have inspired, you know, the world of the Hobbit, rather than, you know, vice versa.
I'm sort of thinking about it in terms of publication. It's a bit like the saga, you know, a bit like I said about the sagas. You know, it's basically a precedent that sort of, you know, almost appeared new to those who didn't know of it. You know, to the uninitiated, you know, it was the secret source of all of the world of the Legendarium that we didn't get until after Tolkien's death. So, right. Yes. Okay. So this, I can't quite read that annotation at the top. This is Orthanc, obviously. At first, I thought it was because of that structure at the top, I thought it was the tower where the eye is, which Tolkien...
Barad-dûr,
yeah, which Tolkien did draw in a roundabout way. But this is sort of, again, something curious to compare to the design of Orthanc that we see in the Peter Jackson films. But you know, it's Tolkien's sort of imagination of the architecture. I mean, it is these designs of Orthanc and the structures in Mordor that you see bits and pieces of in Tolkien's drawings that are, I mean, they absolutely dwarf everything else in his conception. I mean, even the elven sort of structures, if you think back to like Rivendell. So there's a very clear kind of emphasis of the strength of the temporal strength of the powers of evil through their,
yes,
you know, through their, you know, even though of course Orthanc did begin as a symbol of evil, it certainly became it.
Well, I think that's an interesting motif though, isn't it? I mean, Orthanc, of course, was a Gondorian building, albeit the architecture of Orthanc in Peter Jackson is completely dissimilar from anything else we see Gondorian. I think the architecture is fantastic, but it is invariably evil. That is the impression you get from the beginning. But that is the case for, you know, many of the towers, because of course there are so many towers. I mean, one of the frustrations of Tolkien when conceiving the title Two Towers, because of course it went through many revisions of various titles, was that it wasn't precise. Did it refer to Orthanc and Barad-dûr? Did it refer to Barad-dûr and Minas Tirith? Did it refer to Orthanc and Cirith Ungol, which of course is the tower which Bilbo is imprisoned in? Because there's a slight, you know, a different organization. The Cirith Ungol is the end of Twin Towers, not the middle of Return of the King. But the recurring theme, of course, is that these are all man-made structures, but they all progressively become corrupted. So Orthanc is corrupted. And of course, the most famous example is Minas Arnor becomes Minas Morgul. All of these sort of great, you know, towering structures that represent temporal power, one by one, are corrupted. And aesthetically, I think that is a motif which mirrors the idea of total power as exemplified in the Ring as being all corrupting.
Yes, and again, it's very sort of fascinating, because of course there's an implication that, you know, that architecture can be both literal buildings, a physical thing, but also the architecture of, you know, of the world of man, you know, also becomes kind of corrupted by darkness and evil, and also crumbles through ruin, you know, and very sort of very, very specific attempt to kind of make that parallel, I think carries through to the films too. They didn't let that lapse.
Yes, a lot of Ozymandias-esque sort of vibes going on.
Lone and the just stretches away. Yeah. Okay, so the last sort of specific thing I wanted to touch on is Tolkien's very keen interest in cartography, the design of of the world and the kind of mapping of the world that he's created was a, was an abiding interest of, in his. This is actually not a map per se. This is a hang on, my note up. This is a document that he created. Sort of very interested in this because it was an attempt to make a almost a kind of a fake, a false artifact. So this is the I'm trying to remember the name of it. This is the book that is they find in Moria that has the fate of
Yes, in Balin's tomb.
yeah, I can't remember the name of the book. This is the last page of it. And actually, in the film, they show that book and they show the design of that book in the last page of it, where you see the ink line trailing off, as you see here. But I was very interested in this because, of course, Tolkien was literally he literally made a kind of facsimile artifact from his world. I mean, he sort of tore the paper and burnt it. You can see how it's kind of burnt on the edges to represent the kind of the kind of destruction that it went through. So this is quite fascinating.
What I find just interesting about this from an aesthetic level, I mean, I'll allude to it here, going back to calligraphy briefly. This that is that is the inscription on Balin's tomb relaying this back to that scene. Of course, this is Elder Futhark. This is Viking runes. I find it quite fascinating that, because of course, the script is Kerth, and it's written in Khazad-dûl. Which is the dwarven language, but nevertheless, I find it interesting how Tolkien is trying to imagine runic symbols as some form of actual bona fide alphabet written on parchment. Because of course, that wouldn't have existed at all. But nevertheless, I find it interesting that because of course, when that happened historically, they were writing in the Latin alphabet by that time. Sorry, forgive me. Anyway. Just one little note, but this is an element with all of Tolkien's calligraphy. His languages are fascinating in a way, but I think with Elder Futhark and Kerth in particular, the influence is obvious. Moving on to cartography.
Yeah, so cartography. So this is a map with extensive annotations. I mean, obviously, you're not going to be able to really see it, but so
Well, this is Doriath, and so this would have been, I believe, if my geography is correct, north of Middle Earth. And of course, Doriath was the realm of Lúthien, who you can say is essentially the surrogate for Tolkien's wife, Edith, in the Silmarillion. But of course, if we're going over some sort of I'm sorry, I do my throat at the moment.
That's
If we're going over some sort of chronology of cartography, I would have imagined that these early works on Doriath and the Silmarillion would have predated what we later see in Middle Earth, principally because the work and the inspiration came much earlier.
Yes, and I think the bits and pieces of so the map that people are familiar with was actually drawn by Pauline Baynes, who was an illustrator who was not only she was friends with Tolkien and his wife, but also worked very extensively in many of her illustrations. Certainly, the map is being one of the most famous. But she did that, the map that people know, the map of Middle Earth. But it is based upon a lot of these very these much earlier maps, and there's sort of fragments. There's one of the Wilderland and the Mirkwood and such. And so you sort of see this coming together of this type of cartography. I mean, I think very much, even though of course it's Pauline Baynes's map in the end, it is very much Tolkien's idiosyncratic style of cartography that she's reflecting. In that more famous version. And I think that because Tolkien also did a kind of painted version of that later on
And of
as
course,
well.
what I love about Tolkien and how this work mirrors the process and actually mirrors his own in-world mythology. You're talking about how the actual world changed over time, and received, helpings and other influences. But of course, if you look at the music of the Ainur, the creation of the world, of Arda essentially, and of Middle Earth, the world itself goes through several changes, and the landforms change until we arrive finally at this form of Middle Earth. So this is
wonderful.
both out of universe and in universe canonical.
I love that. I love that Tolkien that of course he imagined that the creator of the world would mirror his tendencies as a creator of
Well,
someone
yes,
who changed his mind.
that's true to the spirit of mitopoeia, isn't it?
Yeah.
He is the logos. He is the driving force of the universe.
Force of the universe, yeah, and I mean, what the funny thing, I didn't have it included here, but there was a kind of proof that Pauline Baynes did of the map, and then which she gave to Tolkien, which made extensive annotations on it. I mean, he was even at that stage to making a lot of kind of corrections and changes, So it is sort of fascinating that it all became such a coherent world. But I mean, you see very much a flux, a world in flux when you see these kind of early maps.
Now, I hate to rush you, Dee, but can we very quickly, because we've got about 5 minutes left,
Okay, that's fine.
go over these covers? So first of all, The Hobbit.
Yeah, so I sort of ended with these. I mean, these are just the these are the cover designs that Tolkien made for the Hobbit and for the three books of the Lord of the Ring. The most realized one, of course, is this one of the Hobbit, where he's, I mean, literally, he's conceived of how the spine will kind of work with the design. And this is I think it's a very competent cover. I don't know that this was did they actually use this?
Yes,
It's
I've got
certainly
that version.
you've
Yes.
got that, yeah. I mean, it wasn't the first edition, but
No,
I don't I
my edition is, gosh, the something in the 1980s, but it wasn't the first edition, certainly. The first edition actually, no, I won't try and get it up, we don't have time.
yeah no but it, yeah
But it
but
wasn't this, yes.
it wasn't this, but I mean, of course, we mentioned his difficulties with getting the publisher to accept his designs, but later on he did get the chance, and I this was certainly used. It is very interesting to see him come up with I think quite a competent dust jacket design. And so next is of course the Fellowship of the Ring, F famously of course the Eye of Sauron, in the center here, the Tolkien's conception of it, and of course with the black, the black speech, the famous inscription around the
Yes,
ring and such.
Tingvar and the Black Speech, but also the One Ring, and obviously the, I'm guessing these are the three elven rings
The Elven Ring,
bound
yeah.
to it. Yeah, so obviously the One Ring to rule them all. And of course, the famous Two Towers. Or in this cover, it's very ambiguous because the impression here, of course, is Minas Tirith and
Yeah.
Barad-dûr, rather than Orthanc. Again, the ambiguity of the title.
Yes, because I mean, because I certainly don't picture either Orthanc or Barad-dûr as a white tower, so I'm not sure what specifically. Minas Tirith is probably right, but and these covers were eventually used. I do believe there's fairly recent editions that use the Tolkien designs for the dust jacket. I mean, I would say that there's the germ of a good idea with all of these jackets, but I think I think they were probably right in sort of going with a with a professional designer. Again, I think these are fascinating for people who are fans of the series, but I think that they show the limitation of Tolkien's, sort of abilities in this area. It's a very specific type of design, a book jacket. Then we see the wonderful Return of the King. I mean, again, very much laden with various symbologies that that we're familiar with. course, I can't. My brain is not working. It's very late, so I'm trying to think of the name of that tree. And oh,
The White Tree of Gondor.
the specific name. But anyway, and of course, Mordor was sort of wonderfully depicted. I mean, I think of the three of Tolkien's jacket designs, I like this one the best. But it again shows his sort of overarching concern with the symbolic representations in the book, and using that as a kind of cipher for the work itself.
Yes, I mean there is a historic allusion of obviously to I believe it's the Yggdrasil, which is the life tree, which of course is obviously the motif of the white tree. But I think that's a wonderful place to leave off. We've actually managed to get through all of your images. I won't talk about calligraphy. Maybe that'll have to sort of talk about that some other time. But anyway, thank you very much, Dee. This has been a wonderful and fascinating conversation. I've really enjoyed your insights. So thank you very much for coming on.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I'm very, very pleased to have gotten the chance to participate in Tolkien Day.
Absolutely. So thank you very much. And what will be next after this? Columba will be scheduled after this on this channel. So stay for Columba. He has two more videos, and then afterwards it's Nathan Hood. Anyway, thank you very much for watching, and I hope you continue to enjoy Tolkien Day.